Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, dealing with mass shootings. And Richard, this topic, alas, back up for conversation after we recently had two mass shootings in the space of, gosh, I guess less than 24 hours. One in El Paso, Texas, one in Dayton, Ohio. Fairly different context to each of them, but still similar in that you had a gunman go to a public space and inflict heavy casualties. And the trauma of these events always understandably invites discussions about how we can stop them in the future or at least minimize them. And you wrote a column for Defining Ideas recently on your proposal. But before we get to that, let's talk about some of the other ideas that we've heard in the media and from Congress over the last couple of weeks. Let me start you with the most reflexive proposal, which is some form of gun control. And Richard, you don't need to respond to all of these, but let's just review the bidding right now. Background checks, limits on magazine size, renewing the assault weapons ban, mandatory gun buybacks, licensing gun owners, higher taxes on guns and ammo. These are some of the policies that are being suggested by the Democrats running for president. Any of those worth considering in your
I have to go over them one at a time, but the answer is probably no. But you should start with the first of them and give them to me in slow order so I can
cover. Sure, happy to. First one that I mentioned there was background checks.
Background checks have been used forever and a day. It is quite clear that the people who've done these killings have passed these particular kinds of background checks. So what you're asking is not whether you introduce background tests against a background in which there are no background checks. You're asking whether or not if you strengthen them, it's going to make any kind of difference. They've been strengthened multiple times. And so here the basic rule is one of diminishing marginal returns to additional effort. If you've done all that you can in this particular regard, and it's a pretty elaborate structure, chances are that anything else you're going to do is going to have at most a minuscule effect of what's taking place. That's just the direct effect. The indirect effects are likely to be negative because all of these things take resources and time. And the more money you devote to this particular kind of activity, the less money you have under any fixed budget to devote to anything else which might be more effective. So I tend to think that, if anything, it may well be that the background tests are too severe, but trying to shut them down would, of course, be an obvious non-starter. So I think that the correct item on the correct approach on this item is not to do it. So what's number two on the list?
Number two is limits on magazine sizes.
Well, I mean, you know, this could possibly have some kind of an effect, but you then have to ask yourself two questions. One is, you limit the magazine size, you get a determined killer. Can they expand it voluntarily by making some modest adjustments in their home laboratories? And the answer is probably yes. And then you also have to ask the question, if you have a magazine in reserve, how long does it take you to flip one out and to flip another one in? Suppose that's 2 seconds, it may make a difference. But one of the things that we really do know about this is, if the capacity of the magazine is, say, 100 or 50 kinds of things, the single most dangerous time that you have in any one of these mass assaults is the first 5 seconds. And the second magazine is not going to be involved in that. So I think it may be something worth doing, but I would say the effects on anything you would have would be negligible. One of the things you could do is sort of run back over the past ones and see what happens to the time if, in fact, you did that. I would think that you might be able to save a life or two sometimes. It's not particularly expensive, unlike the background checks. I think it's less implausible, but I think it has a very, very low upside. Third one. So
the next one on the list was something we've been hearing about for years now, which is renewing the assault weapons ban.
Well, I mean, I think the dominant weapon in virtually all of these cases is the handgun. And if that's the particular case, then trying to stop the assault weapon is not going to do things particularly well. There's also a real question of definition as to what is or is not an assault weapon. And there's the further problem about people taking weapons that aren't assault weapons and then modifying them in a black market and using them if they want to do so. So all you can do with a ban on assault weapons is to do something at the point of sale. But guns are durables. They're not, you know, like ice cream cones that melt in the sun. And if somebody has one of them and they decide to go into the black market, they could modify it. And if you have a determined killer, it strikes me it's going to be extremely difficult to think that the ban on assault weapons is going to stop that person from getting the weapon of choice. It's also the case, you can't just think about guns. If you recall some of the really terrible killings in the United States, there weren't guns that were used when you had the situation in Oklahoma City where they took down the Murrah Building and killed 168 people. You think what happened in Barcelona. They were running trucks down the road one way or another. Some people throw bombs down subways. So what may happen is you may reduce the number of deaths by guns, but you may increase them by other kinds of weapons. And so, again, it's this kind of constant upstream control situation. Is I like to think of it as what you're going to do is you're trying to push on a rope and hope that somehow or other, if you wiggle it at the top end, you're going to be able to discipline its movement at the bottom end.
Okay, you got three more. You want to do all three?
Sure, let's do it.
Okay, well, the next one is, I believe, the Beto O'Rourke proposal, which is mandatory gun buybacks.
Well, I mean, first of all, this is, again, it's not a silly proposal. It's just wildly impractical. You've got yourself, say, about 200 or 300 million guns in the United States. Which ones is he going to buy back and why? And what are you going to do with respect to the people who have a gun which is not registered and concealed in order to get the buyback? The likely effect is that people who are law-abiding citizens will tend to turn them in more than other kinds of people. But as John Lott said a long time ago, and it's never been really refuted, there are two issues that you have to worry about. One is the total number of guns in play, and the second is the ratio of guns in good hands and bad hands. And so if you had only one gun out there and it was in the hands of a maniacal killer, you know, he could kill all sorts of people before a bunch of people might be able to drag him down one way or another. And with that particular point in time, it's the 1-0 ratio is extremely dangerous. And so if you have a higher number of guns and a larger percentage of those guns in the hands of good people, that's going to give you a better chance for counter activity on the ground, which is the theme, of course, of my basic paper there. And so I think it's not going to do it. The second question is, you're buying them back at what price, ladies and gentlemen, are you going to do that? And how are you going to prevent people from fabricating other ones or importing them and bringing them into the system from outside again? It's the sort of thing which it strikes you as plausible at the beginning. You go through the mechanics and you realize it's largely political posturing.
The next one, multiple candidates may have embraced this, but the person who's most associated with it, who mentioned it on the debate stage the last time, was Cory Booker. And that's the idea of licensing gun owners. His argument was basically, if you need a license to drive a car, you should need one to own a gun.
Well, I mean, the question is not whether you need a license in many cases. The question is exactly what test you have to pass in order to do a licensing. And, you know, at this particular situation, what he wants to do is to ramp up the test so high that everybody starts to flunk it so that it becomes a kind of a de facto ban. But if you start looking again at the number of people who have gotten licenses, say, under the shall issue rules, or have taken classes, say, from an organization that knows how to use guns, like the National Rifle Association, which is certainly not a much-loved organization in the United States, and asked a fraction of those people who have engaged in this situation or engaged in violent contact, it's probably negligible. So what you're going to do, again, is the same thing you're doing before. You're spending a lot of money to get a lot of guns out of a lot of hands of a lot of people who don't do any harm. The great difficulty with all of these systems is both of the guys who were killing in El Paso and in Dayton were newbies to the situation. They probably could have made their way through any kind of system that you had. The difficulty with both of these cases is there was no effective response on the street at the time of the killing.
And so the last one on that list is the Elizabeth Warren proposal, which, boy, just bears all the hallmarks of an Elizabeth Warren proposal, which is higher taxes on guns and ammunition.
God bless this. Well, I've never seen anybody who purports to be an academic with a kind of specialized skill who is more ham-handed in the proposal she makes. No matter what the topic is, she always seems to get it wrong. And this is exactly like that. What you have to do is you've got to, again, start asking, well, what's the level of the tax that you're going to start to put on this stuff? And is it going to be a de facto ban or not? think about taxes on cigarettes. And what happens is you make the taxes so high, it turns out that you start to see them proliferate in some kind of black or gray market. And that's the kind of thing that's likely going to happen here. It's also, you could only tax new sales. But the moment you announce that a tax is going to go in effect on January 1st, 2020, what will happen is there'll be an absolute hailstorm, quite literally, sale of bullets, guns, and weapons and everything else before the ban in order to start to deal with it. So if you make this tax too high, it's going to be evaded. If you make it too low, it's not going to do much good. What you really have to do is to understand that all the proposals that you've mentioned have the same common defect. They're trying to figure out how you stop guns by keeping them out of the hands of people who shouldn't get them. They're not trying to figure out how it is that you give a response to them once they've shown themselves to be a gun in a situation where people are now in imminent danger of death or serious injury.
So to that point, let's turn to your prescription here. A lot of people, when this topic comes up, make international comparisons to countries with very restrictive gun laws. And you say in this piece at Defining Ideas, you're making an international comparison as well, but on pretty different grounds. You say that the country we should be looking to is Israel. Explain that.
Well, I mean, I actually put it in the article, and my beloved friend Tunku decided to make it the headline, which I think is his prerogative. If you look at Israel, you just check it. It turns out that about a year or two ago, the Army Chief of Staff announced that every off-duty service member, male or female, young or old, has to carry their weapons with them when they're out in public. And this is obviously to deal with a serious threat of various kinds of violence that take place by Palestinians. The interesting thing about this situation is the weapons are not only good in cases of mass killings, but they may well be good in cases of isolated street attacks, or in many cases having people starting to use knives or something else. And so what happens is if you have guns on the street, you're not just targeting guns, you're targeting, hopefully, any kind of attack that people can start to make. And his attitude is that somebody is armed has more options than somebody who is not armed, and he wants to have a lot of people there. He hopes that none of them will be used, and there's a kind of an economic theorem here which says if you have perfect deterrence, you have a lot of weapons out there in the hands of soldiers and police and so forth, and you get no crimes because everybody believes that the price is too high. Obviously, you will get some kind of attempts, but what you have to do is then kind of retrofit the situation and ask yourself, suppose there's an experienced person with weapons who's in one of these buildings when somebody starts to storm in and can immediately return fire. Well, people will say he may well make a mistake. But on the other hand, if you have these guys going on for some time and all sorts of chaos taking place and the SWAT team arrives, they're going to make more mistakes because they will have a less clear view of the situation as it starts to handle. And so the position that I have is the all-purpose line of defense should not be pushing on this string. It should be immediate confrontation at the back end. The moment you start to see somebody with one of these things, the weapons start to come out on the other side. There will be many heroes who might be able to disarm somebody barehanded. Oftentimes, they're military personnel who know enough that they can actually disarm somebody or injure him before the killings start to increase. But I think what you do is you improve the possibilities. What's the likelihood of there being errant kinds of crazy attacks and so forth? I think it's very, very low. The Israeli experience has been going on for a couple of years now, and there have been no reports of untoward incidents where military personnel have gone amok and have started to kill other kinds of people so that they had to be brought down. And it seems to me that we have to understand in the United States that it's not that mass killings are the largest form of killings. They're a tiny fraction of the whole, but they simply sear the national conscience in the way that nothing else happens. This is the best way to deal with them. But more importantly, all of the proposals to limit guns are specific to one weapon, whereas the proposal that I'm making would be perfectly general. And if you saw somebody planting a bomb and you had a gun, you could take that person out. And it doesn't have to do – you could take him out even though there was no way you could stop the bomb from being made. So all in all, I've come to the conclusion, having thought about this, that the basic problem that you have in every legal system is not to define right and wrong. You're not going to have a learned debate in these particular cases as to whether or not the requirement for mens rea, the guilty mind, in a murder case is going to be satisfied by somebody who's a satanic killer. Everybody knows what's right and everybody knows what's wrong. The hard question is when you don't have perfect perfect ex post deterrence, that is instantaneous, perfect response to these characters. And you have to start thinking about other kinds of schemes. The design of the remedies becomes much more important than the definition of the right. And it's on that particular point that I don't think anybody on either side of this political debate has actually thought long and hard about proposals like the Israeli proposals that might actually start to do some good. Just to remind people, a couple of years ago, the Palestinians went in for knife attacks, and I think in a fairly short period in and near Jerusalem, some 26 people, mainly young women, were knifed at bus stops and things like that. And the Israelis decided, well, you just have to get tough against this kind of stuff, and this thing has calmed down. It's also the case, if you remember what happened in Israel in 2002, they used to have all these bombings and other kinds of disasters in open markets and so forth, so that one year in March, I think, they managed to lose about 800 people. And they started putting up walls and breaking down cells and so forth. And those numbers of death have gone down. So it's not as though the Israelis have not been able to succeed at that. They know their back is against the wall. In the United States, nothing is as critical in terms of weapons control as it is in a place like Israel. But since we now think of this as a major problem, then by gum, I really think we ought to try to get the right system of control rather than fiddling around with all sorts of efforts to basically intensify a system of controls that doesn't work. I mentioned just one other thing. Something clearly has worked, and it's probably to some extent the shall issue rules. You know, people who have a basically can get a gun license if they are prove that they are essentially lawful citizens and so forth. But the murder rate in the United States is down by well over 50% since its peak back in 1993, 1994. And so the question you have to ask is, what's going to explain that kind of success? And I think it's basically an all points attack. So I think at the beginning, if you have no background checks and you want to put in a first background check, you may get some substantial pop out of that. But each successive tightening of the screw is going to yield a lower and lower return. So you have to think at this particular point of something new and different.
One final question for you. This goes outside the four corners of the column, but it's something that's been coming up a lot lately. There's always a lot of talk after these shootings about the role that mental illness plays. In some of these incidents in the past, it's clearly been the proximate cause. In others, it strikes me that we may be too quick to conflate malice with psychosis. I mean, you can be evil without being crazy. But Richard, this has given rise to consideration of what are called red flag laws, wherein you can file a complaint, and who you is in this situation really varies depending on who you're talking to. Yeah. But you can file a complaint warning that someone may be potentially dangerous and should have their right to have a gun suspended. A lot of the critics of that idea have raised questions about the constitutionality of those kind of laws, and some have questioned their efficacy as well. How do you think about them?
Well, I haven't thought very much about them, but I'll give you a kind of initial impression. The traditional system of civil commitment did not depend upon red flags for the most part. What often happened is you put people in jail, and they were there for some particular kind of reason, and then their prison sentence is over, but you don't think they're safe to go out into society. It's a relatively restricted population. And you say, look, we're going to keep you here, not because we're punishing you, but because we're protecting others, and we will let you out the moment we think that the situation psychologically and physically has stabilized so that you're no longer a kind of a threat. And that's doing it at a relatively targeted population, which is already giving you some evidence of violence. The moment you start doing the red flags, you have to worry about the question of whether or not this is going to be a kind of revenge killing. So somebody says, I really don't like Jones. I know he captures a weapon. I think he's a real threat because he wears a MAGA hat and he's a supporter of Donald Trump. I'm going to start to report him. Once you report him, then the question is, there are constitutional issues. There are due process issues. Can you simply put this guy in jail for 24 or 72 hours before you give him any kind of hearing? If not, then you have to give him a hearing. He could then flee. It's going to be awfully difficult to start to administer these things because my guess is that the kinds of error that you're going to have by misdesignations are going to be extremely high, that people are going to quickly demand fairly thorough types of situations. So I'm not a fan of a red flag, which doesn't seem to have any trigger. I am certainly much more sympathetic that if you have somebody who's been involved in a particular kind of violent episode at home or away, and you can demonstrate that, that that would then trigger some kind of a government investigation. But it would take more than a complaint. I think what you'd have to do to make this statute even plausible is give a list of fairly narrowly defined causes which would allow somebody to put the kind of wet hat. Let me give you another type of situation which is parallel to this. There's a famous decision now some 40-odd years old called Tarasoff against the University of California. And it had to do with a fellow who is being held in custody. And it turns out that he announces that he's going to kill some particular woman named Titania. And the psychiatric guys examine this person, and they decide, well, should we let him out or should we keep him in? They say, well, let him out. They let him out, and he does exactly what he says. He goes and he kills Titania. And her family then sues the psychiatrist and the police department, saying you should not have let her out, even though it turned out this guy had done nothing wrong, no commission and so forth. Well, the psychiatric community at the time of the decision went absolutely ballistic. And they said, how can you possibly expect us to predict every time we see somebody on a Saturday night who's upset about a girlfriend that this is the guy who's going to commit the murder if we let him go? There have probably been 1,000 cases like this, and we've let go 990 of them, and this is the only one in which it goes wrong. If you hold us responsible for this one, we'll have to keep everybody in jail, and that will be crazy. And this was a really intense debate. And what happened is it was largely diffused by the courts, because it came to the point where literally you had to have very strong evidence that there was a named target and a named guy who had the capacity to do it. So in subsequent cases where it turned out that somebody said, well, I'm going to go out and kill some young boy in the neighborhood, you could not hold the psychiatric people responsible when, as it often happens, something like that starts to exist. I think that ought to be a bit of a caution to us, because if you find that trained professionals are basically shying away from their confidence in their own predictions, the thought that any random person on the street can make one of these kinds of claims and put it into place strikes me as being a kind of a tricky sort of situation. You know, when it comes to these weapons or issues, I don't think anybody should regard themselves as a civil libertarian or an anti-civil libertarian. Getting somebody into jail who ought to be out, or letting somebody on the street who should be in jail. And it's awfully tricky to do these things. But generally speaking, if you had to take a remedial pose, if you really thought that the likelihood of finding somebody was extremely low, then you don't want to do this. I'll give you yet another example, since I'm doing a little bit of free thinking on this. Think about what the stop and frisk laws. The same kind of problem, right? You go up and you see somebody and you start and frisk them, and it turns out 97% of the time it's safe. Well, do you want to continue with it or not? In New York, they cut down fairly dramatically on it, and at least when they were enforcing other criminal laws, it turned out, for the most part, that the crime rates remained relatively steady, and most people thought that this was a solid reform. The real danger in a place like New York now is when you get somebody like Mayor de Blasio, who believes after you have committed criminals, like the kid who managed to wreck the subway trains by pulling the emergency cord time after time, you keep letting those sorts of people out, then you're nuts. Because at this particular point in time, you know you've got a repeat offender, and the probability of him doing something if you let him out is going to be close to one, so you keep him in. So what you have to do is have a real sense of proportion. And the last person you want to charge with any question of judgment is somebody like Bill de Blasio, who on his four-hour work week is never going to be able to think hard or clearly about any kind of question. And the crime rate in New York will start to go up, because releasing criminals is a very different proposition from deciding that you're going to ease back on stop and frisk.
All right. Admirably comprehensive. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter. That's at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting definingideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.